in this session, we're looking at a book by Bob Hitching. It's called McDonald's, Minarets and Modernity. And the subtitle is The Anatomy of the Emerging Secular Muslim World. I've asked two of the students to give some summary of their the chapters they have received to read and to comment on those chapters. So the first four chapters, which deal with what is modernity anyway, the impact of modernity on faiths, Muslim children in the modern world, and Muslim youth, and the Michael Jackson factor. So Ruth is going to kindly tell us something about the contents and to make comments on it. And okay.
Okay, first they talk about the definition of modernity, which is described as both the process of change and the consequence of change in society, and that it's brought on by several influences, which I'll be talking about, that explains this statement. This man mentions the fact that ideas and processes are part of how society is built. And before, it used to be ideas were the thing that was the dominant forces that were fashioning how the people live. But now it's more the processes of how things are coming about, which are easy to distinguish and to define, but it's harder to know how to respond to. So he was just bringing up different ways, different influences of what's happening in society and bringing in eventually about the Muslim society. But the first way that he mentioned was urbanization, talking about everyone is moving into a city, an urban type situation, and there's a big melting pot. So you have a diffusion of cultures. People are no longer bound or held accountable by their culture and their traditions. So there's this anonymous type of an idea, feeling that nobody cares, you just do whatever you want. So the unity of a culture has become more diffuse. Second way, their second influence is pluralism, or in other words, the tolerance for all peoples, no matter what the orientation or worldview. And this affects their conviction and beliefs. When people are forced to live together, we've mentioned this already, but they have no way of really, everybody has to accept what everybody else has to say. And so there's no other option. You have to work with somebody who believes differently, and you don't have the separation of those kind of things. Third one is privatization. And again, several people are forced to coexist for production, and it's not normal for a Muslim, for Catholics, for Eastern Orthodox, for Christians, all those people to live together. But here they are in this situation, forced to work together, which adds all kinds of dynamics as far as relationships and how to relate to someone else. The religion and the culture is private. Influences privatization. That's what I just said. Mm-hmm. And all the religion is private, so their religion is forced to be irrelevant to the public world. So you've got religion in the home, but in the public world, you're a whole different person. Fourth influence is secularization, or the relevancy or irrelevancy of religion. And basically, this secular idea is growing in big ways. They gave some statistics. In the early 1900s, 0.5% of the world population considered themselves secular, and now it's 25%. So in other words, they're not considering religion as an important part of their lives. How this is changing the Islamic world, 50% the average of the age of a Muslim is dropping. Before it was quite a bit different. Now 60% of the Muslims are under the age of 19 years old. Before it was about 10% of the Muslims that were in the urban areas. So there's a change of focus in the urban areas. And then we talked about globalization as far as the facts, the media, all these different things are affecting how the different cultures are viewing themselves. So then he talks about the impact of modernity on different faiths. And what it does is strips the faith from the culture. In Hinduism, gives some examples. Hinduism, there's a change in the caste system. The Jews are now marrying non-Jews, which before was totally against their law. And urbanization means that individuals are anonymous, so it's not my business if my neighbor is this Orthodox person. Pluralism means that we need to be tolerant. Secularization means that religion is irrelevant. And privatization says that my religion is only relevant in private, so who cares who marries whom? So that's just kind of a synopsis of all those things that I was just talking about. For the Muslim children in the modern world, it greatly affects them. There's an attitude shift of hostility towards immigrants coming into the Western world because they're taking over the jobs that normally the people here or in whatever the Western world would have. So there's this hostility going on towards the immigrants, towards different peoples that are coming in, and that's affecting how the children are dealt with. It causes the supremacy of culture of origin to pass away. So their whole culture, as they come into another country, is now gone because, well, it's still there, but it's very much diffuse because of the influences and the hostility that's going on. The kids are influenced by the school system. They come to a different country. There's a different school system. The media, computers, all the internet things that we talked about, they don't have opportunity to really be totally with their own people because they're constantly with other people. So therefore, the whole Islamic faith is not as strong as they're being exposed to other people and other religions. The last chapter was talking about Muslim youth and the Michael Jackson factor. And one statement by Confucius, actually, I thought was interesting. He says, learning without thought is useless, and thought without learning is dangerous. And as we think about how to relate to youth and anyone, actually, we have to really consider what we're teaching them. All over the world, young people are developing similar standards for dress, for how they act, and all that, as was mentioned in another session. The industrialization is resulting in broken families, fathers, sons, daughters to daughters. They don't work together anymore, whereas in the Muslim culture before, it would always be the sons would carry on what the fathers had as far as a job, and the women or the daughters would be learning from their moms exactly how to be a proper wife and how to take care of a household. So basically some things that are happening that are different from the parents' generation is there's a lack of time, short attention spans, not as much emphasis on relationships. Secondly, there's a cynicism towards need in society. You can turn on the TV and see all the refugees in Rwanda being, or all the problems there in Rwanda being with people being killed, and then you can flip it to another station, so you don't have the emotional impact of that, and that's what the TV has done basically to a lot of us. You can just kind of see it and then just go on to whatever. There's a decline in teenage voting, no sense of place in history or geographical cultures, and they have no sense of being in the world to help to change the world. They're just kind of existing. And then finally, attitudes that society and family owes them something is a big factor now. The kids who before were very, very responsive to authority, to the authority of their parents, are saying that their parents owe them something. And that, you know, especially in Muslim culture, is just totally opposite of what they're taught. So with all these different value systems, we need to be loving them. We need to be encouraging and incarnate the innocence and purity because they're just learning so much other stuff being influenced with the evil that's going on in the Western countries. And just to be be living an example to them as youth. That's, and he will go on to explain more about some of the other specific or people groups in a society. But for me, this was helpful just to kind of clarify some of the definitions and some of the ideas of what's happening in this modern world in relation to what was happening before.
Thank you very much, Ruth. And now we'll hear Jay deal with the next four chapters. The headings are The Modern Urban Muslim Marriage, Conversation and the Making of Reality, Drag, Fags and the Underworld, Divorce, Traditional Values and Feminism.
Oh, the controversy of it all. He starts off in chapter 5 dealing with the preconceived ideas that many Westerners have towards Muslims, that all Muslim marriages are arranged marriages. And again, he starts off to remind the reader that indeed there is great diversity within Muslim culture, that there is a middle of a road where even though marriages can and are arranged, in many cases the Muslim woman has the freedom to say no. So there's balance here. And he underscores the fact that in the modern women's movements throughout the world today, that this is also affecting the Muslim world, and he sees this as bringing great change. And then he challenges us, and I quote here, too often missions coming from a conservative perspective breed a male-dominated worldview which fits quite well into a Muslim paradigm. There is much to suggest that a new Christian theology of the role of women may be well overdue in the modern world. Understanding the emergent relationship structures of the urban Muslim couples requires some understanding of the same issues within the Christian community. And though I am a bit concerned with some of the inflammatory terminology that he uses here, I think there has to be great sensitivity here, and it's an important for all of us, you know, as we go as missions to Muslim cultures, we need to have an accurate theology of what the Bible speaks about the various institutions. And so your theology will indeed affect your missiology. And so the rest of the chapter basically, you know, deals with just with the forces of urbanization, and how now Muslim couples, younger couples, they're beginning to develop relationships based more on the thing called love and mutual attraction. And so, you know, there will be this type of tension that we'll face as we begin to make friends with Muslims in those countries. Chapter 6 I found pretty interesting. He talks about conversation and the making of reality. Well, though I kind of disagree with what he says here as conversation as a means of defining reality, I understand what he's getting at. And what he's referring to here is that in the traditional set, the relationship between the traditional Muslim husband and wife was more unitarian, utilitarian, thank you. And that the relationship really wasn't a heart relationship per se. The wife had her role, the husband had his role. Whereas now there is a greater intimacy growing on the part of Muslim young people. And I found that with a contact that we worked with in France, a young believer who unfortunately married a Muslim man. And 2 years ago, when my daughter and I were in France, we met with her in a very appropriate setting, and with my daughter there, and we asked how she was doing. And what she said was, well, my husband's doing well. He's beginning to talk to me more. And so it's interesting to see, you know, the earning of that heartfelt relationship there. And so that's a challenge for us as we think about what marriages are all about. And well, chapter 7, I'm not sure why this chapter is in the book, but I guess he has a particular burden for this aspect of our society, and he underscores the fact that even in Muslim cultures, there is a subculture of homosexual behavior, and that Christians will be addressing that issue. So that's always been there, has been there since eternity, since the fall of humanity, I should say. And so as missionaries, we need to be ready to address those issues, even in a Muslim context. And lastly, he deals in chapter 8 with divorce and traditional values and feminism. And he seems to have a real agenda here on divorce, and I don't want to misrepresent him, so it's important that anyone read him carefully. But he seems to be concerned about evangelical selectivity towards divorce passages. Why should we do some and not the other? And so he's challenging the us as missionaries to really think through our divorce. And so again, you know, it's up to us to understand really what divorce is biblically and how that plays out into the church. And again, he underscores the fact that feminism is building bridges, and it's opening up opportunities for us as missionaries to develop a new dimension of relationships with women. And so, you know, we have a challenge to rethink our theologies and methodologies, according to him. And he is concerned, again, about the sloppy, chauvinistic view of life in the kingdom of God that many traditional evangelicals have concerning that.
Thank you very much, Jay. And the last chapter is called The Restoration of the Sacred. And I'll quote from him here. He says, in short, we have a message. Christians have a message that has become so distant from the reality of everyday life. And everyday people, that our gospel is no longer plausible to modern culture. So he deals with the subject of the sacred, and then of conversion, baptism, prayer, communion, and then ritual, tradition, and liturgy. And finally, catechism. About the sacred, he says, it is such an irony that the time of greatest openness for the gospel in the whole of history has occurred at the time when the very message that we bear has all but disappeared into some kind of subjective existential experience that has little connection with the profound beauty of the creeds and scriptures which affirm that sinful men and women can be reconciled to a holy God by the blood of the cross of Calvary. I think that we do witness this, a subjectiveness in worship and the texts used in worship. There's a deep theology in ancient hymns, and I don't know how deep the theology is in some of the music and some of the songs, and we repeat these often. There's a tendency in certain evangelical circles to respond with the emotions and not with the mind. And mind is very important. Be renewed. Paul says about this in Romans chapter 12 and verse 1, that we need to be renewed in our minds. There's not enough emphasis on mind. And so we are kind of giving a gospel which is made smaller by this the proper balance. It doesn't have the proper balance. So he's mentioning this in connection with the sacred. And then he's saying, under the heading of conversion, let me say, no greater abomination can exist than that this door of Islam, closed for so long, should open as a result of modernity, and then that a modern, cheap gospel should be given. He talks about baptism, and I think what is being said, and the whole matter of baptism is a very important matter. Sometimes Muslims are not free to be baptized straight away, and sometimes people are not properly prepared. And I've been studying myself some of the ancient baptismal formulas and doctrines, handbooks, if you like, for the church. There was generally in the early church an emphasis on renouncing the devil and all his works. It doesn't come in so many formulas today in our modern churches. There was even an anointing with oil. It was the oil of exorcism. But again and again in our modern world, the occult and New Age and some of these things are circulating. There is a great need to, particularly with Muslims who come to Christ, to give this teaching on renouncing the devil and all his works, to have that clear cut experience and knowledge, to renounce formally and the devil and all his works. He writes about prayer and communion, and then ritual, tradition, and liturgy. I became a Christian out of a secular background. In this stage in my life, I'm becoming much more liturgical. In the last few years, I'm seeing the tremendous value of the ritual, well, particularly the liturgies, which give excellent teaching. And I think that I certainly agree with the emphasis on tradition and liturgy, teaching some of the ancient prayers of the church. Muslims come out of a rich background of prayers that they've memorized and of formulations of doctrine and ideas which have been sort of made out or created or hewn at through the centuries. And we can use that. So in some ways, the very traditions of some churches, the Orthodox Church and the Anglican Church and the Lutheran Church, if we're not belonging to any of those, we can still use, there's no reason, you can use liturgy, you can use a bit more ritualism, if you like. I went to church here on Sunday. I was very glad that we stood for at least 10 minutes to sing. It's very, if you think about a Muslim convert who'd be coming into a church, he may get the impression that you just sort of sit around all the time. And it's a terrible, a tremendous contrast to what he's come out of, or she's come out of. The forms of prayer, the positions of prayer, all those positions are in the Bible, by the way, but not together. And so 5 times a day, some of them don't come from that background. But these things are teaching, they're sort of visual aids, and they're part of the teaching somehow. And to literally humble yourself before God, sometimes I deliberately kneel, because I know then that I feel that I am a worshipper. It doesn't. So I think these symbols and these traditions and these liturgies have their place. And because we don't come from those traditions, maybe we don't think of using them. But they can be very helpful, very rich teaching in the Te Deum, and very rich teaching in the Magnificat. But if it's part of the worship, regular worship, it's deep teaching going in. Mary speaks to all the church through her song. anyway, I think I'm grateful for this book, which does give us a picture more of the times in which we are. It sort of is not like the usual textbook that we come across, and sort of because we are in a different world as Christians and as Muslims.